The first basic question is, why do you use? And then you just let the person just riff on it, right? And what happens with us is we have a preconceived idea about why we use.
Are you ready to unlock stories of resilience, triumph, and transformation? Well, you're in the right place because that's what Knocking Doors Down is all about. I'm your host, Jason LaChance, and through my addiction recovery journey, I've found that I have a deep passion for speaking with those that have turned their greatest adversities into their greatest advantages. If this is your first time checking out Knocking Doors Down, hit subscribe on whatever audio podcast platform you're listening on, leave a rating and a review, or if you're on YouTube watching, do me a favor, hit that subscribe button to the channel, give a thumb up on this video, and leave a comment in the comment section, because not only do I see it, but my guests do as well, and they really appreciate your positive feedback. And my guest, Joe Weatherford, literally from Playboy to professor. Joe's journey is absolutely fascinating, turning all of her dark times into her greatest advantage, becoming an addiction expert, TEDx speaker, and mindset coach. In her 20s, Joe was a model who was an alcoholic and addict, partying with all the celebrities in Hollywood. After numerous arrests and failed suicide attempts, it was time to get clean and turn her life around. Joe's got over 11 years clean and living proof that radical change is possible. We get into all kinds of interesting topics, including how to regulate your nervous system through breathing, the challenges she and I both face when it comes to using our phones a little bit too much, and how we regulate that. We take a deep dive into why people use and abuse substances, why they actually begin to self-medicate. We also touch on how her life was jails, institutions, and eventually was going to be death if she didn't make that huge transformation that took place in her life. As well, we talk the complexities of the layers of self-forgiveness and so much more on this episode of Knocking Doors Down. I mean, with this tagline, how could I not want to speak with Joe Weatherford, from Playboy to professor? Thank you for joining me on Knocking Doors Down.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise, and I'm incredibly fascinated with your story. And you know, when we connected and decided to do this, digging in, learning so much more about you, and I just love seeing people prove that you can turn anything around and change is real. You know, that's the biggest resistance I get from newcomers. But I want to dig into gratitude first. Three things you're grateful for. It's how I start my day. So it's how I like to start these conversations.
Oh, beautiful question. Well, I just had an amazing workout. So I'm so thankful for my body being able to run and just experience all of life. It's really amazing. And also to my body for processing all my emotions. You know, I think sometimes we forget. We think about the mind and the soul, but it's the body that actually processes those emotions for us. So exceptionally grateful for that as well. And then my dog. All the time. I feel so, so blessed to be in his life. So
absolutely. Oh, I love it. And you bring a great point that I would love to start there with our bodies processing emotion, because I'll get some newcomers and, you know, I'll talk, you know, pray or meditate through it and always breathe. And this one guy, like, what's with the breath stuff? I'm like, hey, I run high anxiety, which I didn't realize till I got sober. Like, oh my gosh, I have an anxiety disorder. But breath is so huge to help me regulate and calm a lot of situations.
Yeah, it's amazing. They did a lot of studies out of Japan that six deep breaths will regulate the nervous system. That if we can truly be present with our breath and breathe all the way down and in and be with it, that we can turn off our fight, flight, freeze mechanism, which is a beautiful mechanism. You know, we need it sometimes. The body is so wise and gives us what we need, but sometimes, you know, we're not running away from the saber-toothed tiger anymore. The saber-toothed tiger is a mean comment on social media, or your boss looked at you weird. And so we go into one of those fight, flight, freeze states, and the breath is how we get out. And we need to be able to breathe through and move through those moments, and we need to be intact while we do it. So six deep breaths will actually regulate the nervous system. And then we can make decisions from a place of love and groundedness instead of fear and panic.
Right. Well, and as you and I both know, Two people that look towards the, my saying, Joe, is no outside solutions to inside problems. And I certainly looked externally, for chemicals to change when I was in those excessive fight, flight, or freeze modes that I didn't have the tools or the understanding.
I had a very interesting experience for me personally recently. I've been in the mental health field for over 12 years as a professor and counselor and all that good stuff. And I had a situation where somebody very, very close to me that I discovered enmeshed with relapsed. And it just, I went into a state of terror that I've never felt sober before. I'm very fortunate I was able to do this. I went to my family's place in Tahoe in the forest, and I sat down and I said, I'm not leaving this room until I can be with this terror. And it was so crazy because when I think of anxiety, I think of, the stimulating, the energy moving up, and it's scattered and frazzled and chaotic. But then there was this hopelessness. It was the worst mashup ever of like anxiety and depression. I was like, oh, something that my clients have tried to explain to me over the years, but I've never felt both simultaneously. And I had that sense, and I love what you said, like nobody's coming to save you. And there's not a retreat or a guru or a ceremony I can go do or a coach that's going to pull me out of this. Like it is me and me, and I'm going to just feel it. And it took 30 days before it finally lifted. And I was at the end. I was like, God, I'm either going to go to the hospital or you gotta lighten the load. I tap, And it was beautiful because it did start lifting, but it was the first time in my life I really was like, no, I am the only one that can do this. And I didn't outsource my power at all. And it was hellacious and awful. And I don't have kids and I had the time to do it. So I understand that that's not like okay for most people. They're not going to check out a life for 30 days, but I literally did. I lost 20 pounds and I wasn't sleeping and I just sat in that room. It was unbelievable.
Well, I don't want to, discredit what you said, that you were able to go and have that time. But I think people oftentimes overestimate that, how do I want to say it? I had a lot of quit in me. I would quit before I get started. One of my biggest character defects is, oh my gosh, I've already played out a story that this is so daunting. Why even try? But I think people can, it might take them 60 days, 90 days, whatever. There is still within even a busy, chaotic life, be it parenthood, running businesses, whatever it is, that you can spend this time with and for yourself.
That's a great point. I mean, we really do need to put the oxygen mask on ourselves first, metaphorically. And what could be more important than your mental health? It doesn't matter how much money you have or how your kid is thriving or what beautiful view you're looking out from your spectacular home and life that you built when you're miserable. So it has to be prioritized, and we can check in throughout the day. I mean, I'll every couple hours take 3 minutes of stillness and pause. Just how am I? And that's a really difficult question for a lot of people. I remember when I first got sober, I literally had to look at an emotion chart and find, it's like a picture book. Like, that face looks like how I feel inside. I had no words. I had no awareness. I just knew I felt like crap. And I mean, it was such a slow learning process for me, especially coming out. But we need to check in and we need to prioritize our mental health. It's like a relationship. If your mental health was your marriage, how neglected, how shit talking, we have got to make that our most precious relationship, in my opinion.
I agree. And that's when people oftentimes ask me about that slogan. It's that kind of four stages of cognitive awareness. And I might restructuring, I might mess this up, but like awareness, and then you take appraisal of the situation. And then once you kind of have that, you can adopt new ways and reevaluate constantly. And I think it's just a really challenging thing to do when we look in the mirror on it, because we're not always subjective.
Yes. Well, and like you said, you know, we have these unconscious programmings. I mean, it's great you were able to identify yours and go, wow, okay, I play this story out. And at the end, I've already told a negative outcome at the end, right? So that's one that's risen above the line of consciousness within you. But how many of those stories are on automatic programming running beneath the surface? I mean, if we have 90,000 thoughts a day, 60,000 are negative, and most of those are repetitive. So our unconscious programming is running so much of our life. That's where we must pause, reflect, do everything that we can to identify those patterns and really try and see what is my philosophy? How am I moving in life? Is my energy grasping and desperate, or am I in a place of receiving and gratitude? I mean, like you said, I start every single time with this gratitude. It matters. You're shifting your energy. You're tuning yourself into a different frequency. And those are the things that are available to us. We have to be utilizing them, though. That's always the issue, right? You know what to do. You just don't do it. So.
Well, and at the end of the day, I mean, tell me if you ever have this with people that you've worked with. I've had a couple of folks that I've done some recovery coaching with, and you know, giving them assignments. And these aren't dissertations or anything. And it's like, hey, you know, what did you get back? Oh, I didn't do it. Okay, so you're just lazy. You're just lazy on yourself. You know, and I get it because I've been through recovery. You have too. You know how hard it is and how painful it can be of unraveling so much. So I give them grace, but there is a time where you just have to go, yeah, I can't continue to be a lazy shit about this.
Right, exactly. And it's not even so much about the thing, right? Like the assignment. It's about who you are as you show up for yourself. That is you telling God, the universe, like, I'm here for it. And bring those blessings on, like, give me some assistance. It's if you're not doing your part, why would God?
Knocking Doors Down by Carlos Vieira, now available wherever you get audiobooks.
I wasn't done partying, and I didn't want the binge to end. I think I knew that when I finally got home, I'd have to face what I had done, and I wasn't ready to do that. Being responsible for my actions wasn't something I was looking forward to. I had abandoned my wife and baby, my family, and my business. I wanted to avoid the shame of returning to what I had left behind. Even though I was not yet going home, I wasn't sure I had enough resources to continue the binge.
Click the link in the podcast description to find out more.
It's one thing to sit there and go, oh, please help me. And it's like, okay, now your turn. Like, what are you going to do? You know, show up. And if you're going to hire a coach, yeah, it's do the assignment. You know, this isn't college where you're paying $40,000 a semester and you get a grade and all that. You are choosing to be in therapy most of the time. My clients, at least, I don't work with mandated people. And some of them might be coerced in some way, you know, like they're going to lose their marriage if they don't or whatever. But it is a choice. And I think that that free will is really important. But then with people, it's like, you said you wanted to do this. You trust me, you hired me, I'm telling you to do it, and you're not showing up. Why? And then we get into those self-sabotaging, and sometimes it is straight up laziness. Like, I literally told somebody the other day, I'm like, yes, you have trauma, we all do, and it's significant, and I'm not minimizing it or downplaying it, but your problem is your arrogance. You've had everything handed to you, you know, you are good at everything, you're a high-level CEO, because that's typically who I work with. And you're arrogant. And that is your problem. It's not your trauma. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's so having those really honest conversations with people, but then also with ourselves. Because I can look back and go, yeah, there are times I hired somebody, they told me to do something and I didn't. And it was just sheer laziness and the amount of distractions in this life right now, you know, between social media or whatever it is, we are leaking energy all day, every day into things that don't matter.
Yes, absolutely. I would love to get into that with you. Thank you for bringing that up. I will go and speak oftentimes to some local high schools and classrooms, and kids will, you know, ask me things. And I, you know, I had this one kid finally ask me a question and I go, I'm amazed. And he's like, I'm like, you were in your phone the whole time. I asked for 45 minutes. Like, examine the issue there. I recently went to a concert, one of my best friends, and they have a no phones mandate. And the lead singer was the band Tool. And he goes, "All right, we want you to be with us, engage with us tonight. Let's keep those phones away. And if you're good little boys and girls, we'll let you film the last song. And if you can't keep your phone away for 2 fucking hours, you got a problem."
Oh, I love that.
And
I love it.
The cool part of it, Joe, I was sitting there and there was like a break between songs. And what was the first thought? Oh, I should check and see if I got any messages. And I was like, whoa, whoa, okay.
It is amazing, that FOMO and that I want to capture this. I want to be able to revisit it, you know, and then we're missing that magical moment of experience. And it's really fascinating. I just downloaded this app called Opal, but there's a million of them, right? And it literally locks you out of your apps. It's an app. It's like puts you in timeout every day. And even me, I have very strong discipline practices. I suck at self-regulating with my phone. And so I'll tell you, I had a really interesting experience. 2 weeks ago, I was heading into an ayahuasca ceremony. And earlier in that day, I'm romping dirt bikes around the hills of Mexico. I lost my phone. And I mean, this is in the middle of nowhere. There's no signal. There's no pinging. Gone eternally. And I'm in Mexico, right? So I can't get a replacement now for a couple of weeks. And I'll tell you, it was so crazy. My first thought was like, good. I felt this sense of relief.
Sure.
All that old energy, all my old life, all those old photos that I was clinging to and everything I needed and all those old contacts that aren't even a part of my experience anymore. That phone had so much old, stagnant, stale energy in it. I almost felt relief. And then I'm like, well, now I have a perfect example. I can put a post up on social media saying I lost my phone. Don't even try to get a hold of me. And I felt awesome. But the amount of times during the day that my automatic brain was like, check your messages, bop, 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 whatever, was insane. And it was cool for a week. And then by the second week, I was like, oh, this is gnarly. But even in my journey, what I was so spoken to was these distractions, like protect your energy. The energy that we put out, make it so precious that you want to protect it.
Right.
Not everyone should have access to you, and you certainly don't need access to everyone. So this more like being exceptionally diligent and intentional with who we are participating in this dance with. It was a beautiful, very ass-kicking experience for me.
I love it. And I love that you brought up accessibility, because that's a thing that people, I think the boundaries is a little bit overused. And I talk accessibility with people, you know, because the best way I can clarify it, there's certain people we're only going to have conversations about the weather. There's other people that I'm going to let you know my deepest and darkest secrets, because I can trust you to have it in your hand and not crush me with that knowledge.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to teach people that wanted to be therapists, and, you know, so it's interesting, right? Like when you're working with somebody, but when you're in any intimate dynamic, there is a natural giving and receiving, and we're always navigating how much of ourselves do we want to be known, right? Like, how much am I going to reveal? How much am I going to take on? Obviously, when you're in a counseling relationship, you're there to serve them. You're not talking about yourself. But it comes down to this fundamental question of, can I let myself be known without any expectation of how it is received? And that to me is always the question, because I want people to know me. I mean, from a business standpoint, that's why they hire me. So I'm very transparent with my story, my life. I post all the time about real things that are happening in real time. But when it comes to like some of those deeper layers, people need to earn it. They really do. And that keeps everyone safe. It's just smart. And it's interesting, the conversation on boundaries. Oh, well, you're just overprotecting yourself, or that's your unhealed trauma. And I think it's just common sense. And it allows us to be more free. If I know where the edge is, I can meet it, because that's my personality. I'm always going to find the edge. But I know where it is, so I can move with a lot more freedom within that space.
Yeah. Well, and us people, you know, tell me if this doesn't resonate with you and our full-blown addiction, discernment wasn't exactly a thing that we used.
Oh, God. Yeah. There's none, you know. And when I think about addiction, so my thing was alcohol. That was my primary. Of course, there are lots of little tendrils to lots of things, but sure. Alcohol for me was the biggest thing. And I love this analogy. It's like if you're going to use a doTERRA oil or an essential oil, right? So you take a plant and then you put it in ethanol and it extracts the essence out of it, right? So for me, being this living organism, this plant, I am putting so much alcohol in, it is literally extracting the essence out. And so I was just kind of like this weird avatar, you know, moving around the world and looking for connection and finding it in the worst of ways, the most atrocious of places. And there was no discernment because I was so disconnected to myself. There was no self left. Yeah. It was like a 15-year possession. There's just no other way to put it.
Yeah, no, and I can relate. I always use the, I killed my spirit with spirits, you know, that's kind of wording seems to connect with people. But let me ask you, I'm just curious, you know, knowing your story, and I'm glad we're talking solution here because I'm more about that than the past. But I do want to ask, like, you know, in childhood, was that where maybe like the chameleon started to come into play to protect yourself? And, you know, a lot of these coping things that we develop in our early years that eventually, well, we end up where we do.
Yeah, I think I always felt like I didn't belong. I kind of came into this world with that feeling. And so many of us have that. Mm-hmm. It's very, very relatable when I say it. So I felt like I didn't belong. And then I developed this false self that I thought could connect. And it's like a hologram of yourself, right? So mm-hmm. that's the you that's out in the world making decisions. And then we think we're that. And then we lose the truth of who we are. And that's what happened to me. And my addiction, I mean, I could go into all of the things that happened. I mean, being molested at 4, that was a pretty significant moment. Being raised by people that were alcoholics, that social learning, you know, and then we get into, well, is in the environment or genes, and it's both, you know, and I just came in with the perfect storm. And I remember the first time I drank, though, I really had my first heartache. I was 12. And I just remember I made the worst jungle juice you could ever imagine. I don't know what was in it, but it was, I'm sure, like gin, wine, just bleh, gross, right? And I put it in this water bottle. And I had just gotten off the phone with my 19-year-old boyfriend. So you can just already trace like how my life went. And I remember I slammed this concoction and it was the first time I felt okay. Mm. Like I was numb. I mean, it is an emotional anesthetic. And I was just like, oh my God, this is the feeling that I've been craving, and how sad to be 12. And that's the feeling that you're craving to experience. Yeah. And it worked, you know? And so like anything, there was a point of diminishing returns that came real quick for me. I was a full-blown alcoholic, definitely by 14. But it was an unbelievable experience for me. I was like, ah, I'm home.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it took some ramping up, and I was one of those individuals that this is not going to be me. Like I was telling you, in a home of addiction and family members on both sides. And if something happened around 22, when I just went, oh no, it's fine, I'll start drinking, and then, you know, escalate probably about a good another 15 years after that it was like, oh my gosh, I got a problem. And it's not just this drinking thing. It's a lot of underneath stuff. As a matter of fact, that is the problem. And this is why I think that the chemical is a solution.
Absolutely. And I love Dr. Gabor's work. You know, Dr. Gabor Mate is the one that said, we need to know what's right with the drug. So when I'm working with people, that's the first thing. I'm like, what does this do for you? Mm-hmm. You know, who does it allow you to be? What does it allow you to feel or not feel? Because that's why we use, to start feeling something or to stop, you know, and that doesn't mean at an addicted level. If you're somebody that drinks normally and you go out to a cocktail event and you're feeling some social anxiety and you have a couple glasses of wine and then you feel more at peace, that's what you are looking to experience. And it's really important that we ask those questions. We don't need to be full-blown addicts to go, okay, what is this social anxiety that I'm feeling? Because emotions are precious messages, and they will let you know when you are living outside of your truth. And if we can have the courage to pay attention to them and know they're not real, but they are true. And it's just simply we're out of alignment, and we can get really compassionate as we explore why, like, why is this showing up for me? It's really beautiful work.
Yeah. What are some of the things maybe that you use with your clients that you'd be willing to share on helping them land on that why? I knew what my why was, but it took me some digging to get a bit further into understanding behind that why.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different layers to it.
Have you dug into the archives of past Knocking Doors Down podcast episodes? The Knocking Doors Down podcast archive is available to you for free. Check it out. Here's a snippet from when Charlie Sheen was on the podcast.
AA is not the best place for a famous atheist. I kept looking for that fucking chapter. What, you know? So yeah, but it's not a one size fits all.
Sure.
You know, it's like saying that we all think the same, like our brains are built the same. They're just not.
Right. Yeah.
There's such uniqueness involved.
Check out this episode and so many more in the Knocking Doors Down archive. And while you're at it, hit that subscribe button, give this video a thumb up, leave a comment, and share with somebody else that you know will get value out of the Knocking Doors Down podcast.
The first basic question is, why do you use? And then you just let the person just riff on it, right? And what happens with us is we have a preconceived idea about why we use. And so what I do is I keep pushing, and I do an exercise with my clients where I tell them, I'm going to ask you the same question 7 times. I want you to answer right off the bat, and you cannot repeat the answer. And that really helps us get into some of those deeper layers. So they can never say the same thing twice. And usually by the 5th response, we hit a tender spot, and it's like, oh, I didn't even know that was there. And then, you know, it's so interesting. And it's like being on a spiral staircase, right? Like we think that we've mastered or got the lesson or worked through something. And then there's just all these different layers and attachments. I love internal family systems theory, where we look at those wounded parts, then the parts that came on board to protect that part. How does that serve? You know, so it's really just this beautiful storytelling, but it always comes down to worth. You know, at the end of the day, it's believing that we're not enough. And one of the best questions that I ever ask people, I heard Tony Robbins say this years ago, and it's just brilliant, is when you think about your early childhood, who did you have to become in order to be loved? And that's where we really start dissecting that personality that we have created, you know, because what part of you had to shut down in order to become something else?
Yep.
So when we talk about trauma, it's not just what happened to us, but also what didn't happen.
Right.
You know? And so now we're just breaking open Pandora's box, which I personally, I love, you know, I like bring it, because I don't want leaking out in my relationships or preventing me from living just the most full expression of my truth.
Right.
So I really dig this work. It's not easy. It's painful. But there's a way to like grieve with reverence. There's a way to do it with dignity. There's a way that you can know that you have you. And most of us, especially in early recovery, don't have that. That's where it's very important that you have somebody walking through this process with you, because that's really what we're doing when we're coaches or therapists or anything else. It's like, I will help you hold this as you find your center.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And let me ask you, have you ever done anything around story work? Because it was really beneficial for me. I had a friend of mine that he walked me through it and helped me reframe the way I was seeing myself. Because, you know, I say very mean things to myself. And so that's taken a lot of work. And so in that reframing, it brought me to a more empowering perspective upon things in the past, which also helped me ditch a lot of that victim mentality.
Absolutely. I love that. And yes, I mean, just even the basic cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, is so effective when we go, okay, because it's never what happens to us. And it's always the story we tell around it.
Right.
You know, in my TED talk, I use the example, somebody can go through a divorce, right? And so if their first thought is no one will ever love me, I'm doomed for life, then you're depressed, you're unhappy, poor me, right? Miserable. Somebody else gets divorced and they're like, okay, great. That was painful. I learned. Now I'm free to meet somebody that I'm really going to just thrive with. So it's the same experience, two different stories, but we have to go, okay, what part of me believes I don't deserve this? Mm-hmm. And we do have to clean up our side of the street. Where was I out of alignment? You know, where do I need to level up in order to have a healthy relationship? So there's all these different ways in which we need to navigate the reframe. You know, it's not enough to just be like, oh, I don't love myself. Okay, reframe it. I love myself. Well, you don't, you know, that's why mirror work doesn't work for a lot of people.
Right.
And I am always shocked, you know, through it all, I'm very fortunate. I always had love for myself on some level, even just, I also hated myself a lot, but there was some love there. And I work with so many people that cannot look in the mirror and say, I love you.
Right.
It's just too shattering for them. And it's such a foreign concept. And it's like, I don't know. For me, if you're here, there is a purpose and a reason. It is so miraculous that you landed on this earth. There is no way your life is a mistake.
Yeah. Well, is that a part of your faith? Because you did bring up God a few times. And for me, like people ask me, you know, now, because I am a person of faith and spiritual, I believe I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. And when people ask me about that, like my struggles was, no, I always believed in God. I just didn't believe there was one that loved me and had a purpose for me.
Absolutely. And I learned from all the different teachers, you know, take from Buddha, Christ consciousness, like all across the board. They all have the same message for the most part, you know, just different avenues to get there. But yes, I mean, I know that we are here for a reason. I know that our souls are here to expand. And it's often through messy, horrific, awful times. You know, we don't grow when we're comfortable for the most part. Now talk about shifting a story. I'm really diligently working to shift that one for me. I don't want to grow through horrific pain and loss anymore. I'd really love to just like, you know, be dedicated to my practices and continue to evolve and grow through love. But, you know, we're here to be messy. We're here to make mistakes. We're here to face challenges. And it's, you know, it's like if there was a video game that there was no bad guys and you just passed every level, you wouldn't play it. You know, it wouldn't be any fun. So if we can talk about rewiring for more grit, we talk about resilience, which is great. Being resilient's phenomenal and it's an important skill. And grit to me is where I like to play. It's like, ooh, cool. All right, really? Let's figure this, you know, and like make it fun.
Yeah. And it can be. I did a share because I still attend 12 steps sometimes because, you know, hey, it helped save my life. But I also got to that point like, ooh, I got to live life beyond this. And goodness, I've now blanked on my thought on what I shared. It was really good, Joe.
Life changing.
Yeah, it was going to be the ultimate, you know,
ten million
downloads. Oh, well, we'll segue here because I want to ask you about, because I've been interested, but the nearest therapist that does it is about an hour away on neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. When in your studies did this kind of come forward and what are some of the values that you see out of it? This is an incredibly selfish question right now.
Yeah. You know, for me, just to really hit home to the meat of it, for me, what I love, it's energetic resonance. You know, when you can find the emotion word that truly speaks to your unconscious, it's like now all of you feel seen, heard, appreciated. It's like, it's the deepest level of truth. And so when we can find those words and that energetic resonance for what your soul really needs, it listens. And there's lots, I mean, there's so many different ways to do NLP. I tend to do a lot with muscle testing. I muscle test different emotions and words and strengths and you know, eradicating stories and re-imprinting new belief systems and then testing to make sure that it's landed and all sorts of things, right? But when we can get super, super present with ourselves, the energy of words and being able to specifically identify those emotions can be so unbelievably powerful.
Absolutely. And I don't think people give enough credit to language. And really how it affects, especially the language we use with ourselves. Like you said, those 90,000 thoughts a day, 60,000 negative, oftentimes subconscious and generally towards ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, words matter. That's why we call it spelling, right? Casting spells. It matters. You know, you don't think words matter. Walk into your partner and tell them you want to sleep with somebody else. Words matter. You know what I mean? They are powerful. But then we bring on the somatic expression of all of it, right? So it's interesting. We talk about storytelling. A lot of times clients or people with trauma will speak from the neck up. Like that truth has not really been embodied yet. And so it's another important aspect of work is like when you're sharing your story, how much of you is on board? Because if all of you cannot be on board through that, you should not be sharing it publicly yet. Again, those are the times to work with somebody who has earned it, who can help you move into those deeper, deeper layers of truth. So are we speaking heart-centered? You know, is there energy blocks within the body? And as we're speaking this new way of being, are we tight? You know, are we not allowing the breath to come in? Because the body, the mind, the soul, they're not interconnected. They are one. You know, there's not just like these little brief intersections. It's like asking yourself, what part of me is not fully on board right now? And then tend to that and then start doing more of that affirmative work. I love when I went to rehab, I went to a really, really crazy rehab. It was an aversion therapy treatment facility. So, you know, you would drink like 20 glasses of alcohol after you drank a water bottle full of Epicac and you just puke your guts out for like 24 hours. It was horrific. But the next day you would do a treatment with Propofol. So that's what Michael Jackson overdosed on. Yeah. They would put you under, but not fully. And then you do a counseling session with your unconscious. You'd wake up in a different room, listen to this tape that had been recorded of an hour counseling session, but they would implant, right? While you're in this altered state, affirmations such as, I don't drink anymore. I don't choose alcohol. So whenever we can get into that place where we are out of the way and it's that full soul expression, and then we start doing this work, the words land differently. We're no longer planting seeds. We are sprouting miracles, you know? So we have to get out of our own way though. And there has to be that true desire for change.
Absolutely. And I love that you brought up the I don't drink, because there's something when you actually say that and it's real that you're like, well, I remember the first time I said that when somebody asked me, I was like, no, thank you. I don't drink. And I was like, oh, holy shit. Like that felt really good. Like my whole body, it felt really good going through it.
Yes. And that's, you know, we need more people to talk and speak about it, because, you know, when I was trying to get sober, all I saw was people that were white knuckling it. You know, they might have been sober for even 20 years and they were like, I can't miss my meeting because then I might drink. And I'm saying that with compassion. I'm not making fun of anyone. I just, for me, I was like, oh my God, that sounds like hell. You know, if I have to white knuckle this forever, I'm just going to do it, honestly, because I'd rather be up and miserable than sober and miserable. And I really didn't have a lot of examples of people that were out there just living this phenomenal life. I just saw people that were like holding on for dear life. And that's one of the reasons I talk about this so much, is because I am honored and so grateful to be that example of somebody that I haven't drank in 12 years and I never miss it. There's not one ounce of me that ever wants that. I wouldn't, just like I wouldn't drink nail polish. Like now, I don't drink. Really, every cell in my body means it. And I am so happy.
Yeah. Oh, it's, I don't know about you. My tape plays out pretty quick with any of the thoughts. I immediately think about the illness, the consequences, the hangover. It's like everything about it is incredibly unappealing.
Yeah.
It's not just a, I don't want to. It's like, every part of my soul just, no.
Jails, institution, and death. For those of us that were really in it, you know, that was our experience. I mean, I sometimes have flashbacks. I mean, I got put in a psych ward in San Francisco. And let me tell you, if you were going to go to a psych ward, San Francisco is the spot to do it. And I had been on this bender. I don't even remember what I did, but I wake up in this hospital and I'm chained to a bed again, you know, and then I'm looking out into the hallway. There's some dude. I'm like, oh, he's making a puzzle. That's cool. And I have this sense of peace. And then I realized he was eating the puzzle pieces. And then it hit me that I'm in a mental institution again. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, you know, I'm in jail, like so much. People see my life now, you know, I live in Cabo, I'm on the beach, like have phenomenal friends, I really happy, and they just don't get it. You know, they don't know how dark and awful it was. It's like, I have been there. You would never know it now, but trust me, like the depths of hell, I have been there. I have woken up in a bathtub with sheets stripped after being violently raped. Like the human spirit is so, I mean, going to that word resilient, like it is amazing what people can overcome. And I see it all the time with people. They blow my freaking mind how strong and amazing and how much they can keep their heart open and love and forgive despite just the worst atrocities ever. But like, I don't know, we need to put that out there so that people that are in it can hear it. And it's almost like activation codes. It can be you too, because I am not special. I am not. And if I can do it, literally anyone can do it.
Yeah. Likewise, I will mirror that statement. Let me ask you before we get to random questions, and we're going to have to do this again down the line. I'm having a blast conversing with you. The forgiveness process, it's important. Yeah. For me, it was easier forgiving others that had wronged me than me myself. How about you? And maybe I'm going to guess probably some people that you work with, something similar.
Yeah, the layers to forgiveness, it was always easier. I mean, I was in my victim consciousness, like full blown, you know, blaming the world. And so at first, I got a lot of benefit from learning to forgive other people. And the empathy started coming back. And then the realization of like, there's really not a lot that I haven't done. I have hurt a lot of people. I have whatever, you know, and you just start understanding that we're all way more similar than not. And then the grace comes in, right? And then there's that deeper layer of self. So that work for me it's still so much ongoing. I really feel I've done a lot of the forgiveness work. And then again, I'll hit a new layer, or I'll become aware of some new depth of disgust or hatred that lives in me for me. And I'm like, oh God, what's that? I didn't even know. So it's this ongoing process, but I really dove into forgiveness. So a year and a half ago, I left my husband, and it's been just like the most insane, gnarly divorce you could ever have. Oh, I mean, gosh. I'm sure I get challenged on that, but it's not as much as I was like, I want what's fair. I respect you. Like, let's just end this. Like, that was not going to be the way this goes down. So the forgiveness piece for me, I dove into it. The best thing I learned about forgiveness is this. It's all about acceptance. When I think about forgiveness, I think about like, oh, I have to love this person, or I have to whatever. No. You have to accept. And when you really look at the root of what the word forgiveness means, and you trace it back to ancient times, it comes down to indignation. And it's like, this shouldn't have happened to me. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're in that victim, this shouldn't have happened to me, there is no acceptance, therefore there is no forgiveness. So forgiveness doesn't mean I'm gonna give you access to me. Forgiveness doesn't mean I'm gonna show up for you or put any energy and love out towards you. It doesn't mean any of that. It means I accept it. And it means I forgive. And then all of a sudden that power is coming back to me. I'm no longer leaking energy, trying to control this person, this situation that is completely beyond. Now we're going to show up and do what we need to do, right? Like, I've got a ton of legal that I'm constantly showing up for, but I'm like, I'm not going to do it angry. I'm just going to show up because I don't want to be angry and bitter. And I have worked now for a year and a half on this. And I'll tell you, I had the coolest experience the other night. So my ex-husband and his new girlfriend live in a house, and I live in the house like behind it. Okay. It's really fun. So I used to see him and my whole body would contract just like, you know?
Yeah.
The other night, it was a beautiful sunset. I'm looking over the ocean. I'm up on my roof. And then my ex-husband and his girlfriend came up on the roof. And so I see them. And my first thought was, I hope they're happy. I didn't have to try. I didn't have to work through anything. I was like, I genuinely hope that they are happy and healthy.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, holy I did it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm trying so hard, you know, to get there, and it finally landed, and it feels so much better.
Yeah.
Like, why would you ever not want that? It frees me. It frees them. It's like, oh my God, it was the most amazing moment. Honestly, after the year and a half of just hell, I was like, ah, I finally got it.
Yes. I'm proud of you. That's tough. I'm really proud of you. That is, oy. Oh, I light bulb. I remembered where I wanted to talk with you about, if you're open to this, because we both went through some sexual trauma. How did you start to find, people go watch the TED Talks and other stuff Joe's done where you tell that, open up. I mean, at least I feel emotional conversing about it, but I really wanted to with you because, selfishly, how did you start to find a healthy sexuality? I've gotten better because my picker got really good. I realized and I accepted, ooh, I'm getting so much of the same because I'm not changing. And when I did those changes, and I'm in a good place, good, healthy relationship, but there's still some prevailing thoughts in there at times, and she's really patient and you know, listens, and I'm very blessed by that. But for you, what was some of that work?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And I'm so excited for you. I really, one of the most precious gifts when we have been violated sexually, to be able to reclaim our power. And I'll speak from a woman's perspective. You know, our womb is the source of creation. It is life. Our sexuality is so deeply intertwined with our overall happiness, the depth of intimacy that we can hold. I mean, it's a great question, right? Like, if you're somebody that can have like only one orgasm and then you got to jump and get out of bed, you can't like, what is your capacity to hold pleasure? It is so deeply intertwined with our sexuality. And for me, I hated mine. I developed being molested at such an early age. The story that I assumed was, I'm only desired for my sexuality. That is the only reason men will love me or want me.
Mm.
And so that story played out pretty true throughout my experience. And then, of course, working in the adult industry and everything else, I look at my life and I go, of course I landed there. You know,
yeah.
I'm not even ashamed of it. It's just like, of course. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, actually where I did most of my work was through intense relationships with men I really loved that had a lot of sexual issues. And so me being somebody sexually traumatized, I found and attracted and magnetized into my life men that were sexually traumatizing. And so it was through these betrayals and through porn addictions and everything else, I had to find myself. And so I don't recommend that people do that work. that. I highly, highly discourage it. But for me, that's honestly what it was. And then I did have somebody that was really safe, that I was working with a coach intensely on healing my sexual trauma. And he held space beautifully for me as I was able to do that work. And it's been interesting. Now I've been single for a while, for the first time in my life sober. I am like I'm a love addict, just a relationship, you know, one after another. So it's the first time in my life that I'm single. And I'm also really protecting that energy. I'm not saying I wouldn't have sex with somebody, but it's like, I'm very discerning with who I share that part of myself with now. So all of a sudden, this is my first time in my life I've really taken a long, extensive break and not had sex. And the power of like harnessing that energy is so magnificent. The that is coming into my life, these magnificent gifts, and I can feel it is in relation to me really harnessing that energy. And I do a lot of Kundalini work and tantric breath and everything else. Like I get to play with my sexuality now. And it's funny because I used to be so rigid. Like I posted a picture of myself in a bikini once and my ex-mother-in-law unfriended me. And then like I had a lot of mixed messages and very shaming about anything around my sexuality. So now that I'm not having sex, I'm actually so much more sexually liberated. Sure. It's really this fun place to be at. But that one rape that I discussed that was exceptionally violent is actually what got me sober.
Wow.
So when that happened to me, it was the first time in my life I knew it wasn't my fault and that I didn't deserve it. Mm. I had never once felt compassion for myself. All the bad that happened to me was my fault. And this one, I'm not going to go into the details, but whatever happened and transpired, it was the first time I felt genuine sadness and concern for myself. And that is really what started opening the path for me to get sober. And I shared this story once at Auburn University, and this young woman came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, I heard your story and I appreciate you telling it, and I've never had that yet. And it was very illuminating for me to remember that when I'm sharing that experience, I just always like to say as well, if you haven't had it yet, you deserve it.
Yes.
It wasn't your fault. And just set that deep intention to feel that love and compassion for yourself. Like daily is a practice. Ask to experience it, because truth is always true, whether you believe it or not. And that should have never happened to you. So it's like, how do we open to that self-compassion? Because that, for me, was a life-changing experience.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. I appreciate it. And I just think it's so valuable. I mean, I just see it with so many young people now. I mean, gosh, forget what social media, and just, you know, probably Reddit or something, and I'm in the addiction category and like to see it in these, you know, young men and women, porn addict, a sex addict, you know, and I've seen it in two ways. People that went through unfortunate things similar to you and I, they go one way or the other. They become totally impotent, or it's full blown crazy. I was more the full blown crazy. Yes. And it's just really sad to see such a beautiful, wonderful gift that, I don't know, gets perverse. I don't know what other word to use. I don't know that that's the right word, but, you know, I don't know. It just shouldn't be. It's a gift, not a tool. I don't know. I'm trying to find the words.
Yeah, I mean, the objectification, the manipulation, the way that we can, you know, distort this beautiful, what's really meant to be a spiritual experience.
Yes.
I mean, it's like we can even have a very conscious hookup, you know, when you meet somebody and you don't want to be in a relationship, but you want to meet that need. It's like, how do you have that dialogue with somebody? What are your boundaries, your fears, your desires? What does this mean for you? If we're to exchange in this way, like, what is the meaning of it? I mean, having high conscious, even hookup sex is possible. It just takes an exceptional amount of vulnerability and honesty and communication. And I have always been very pro women and their sexuality, however they want to express it. And what I will say is this, having been somebody that dove fully into promiscuity and lots of partners and all that, I would have never done it sober.
Right.
So what I will challenge you on is, if you are somebody that's, you know, in that world and conscious, you know, or unconsciously having a lot of sex and you're high or drunk to do it, really pay attention to that. Because I wouldn't have done like 95% of the things that I did.
Same.
I didn't know her. I don't, right. And again, I don't shame myself for it. And those experiences probably saved me. You know, thank God I had something to look forward to once in a while. But you know what I mean? It's like, no, I would have never done that sober. So if you're in that position where you're not going to fuck somebody sober and you're just out there, like, just open in that way, because my thing, it's not a moral issue. It's a self-love issue. Yeah. I will challenge that all day long.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that falls very much under that umbrella of what I say, no outside solutions to inside problems. Because, and you said it earlier, no one's coming to save you. No one's coming to fix you. And I'll tell you that that hookup definitely ain't going to solve your problems or fix you.
Yeah, that weird dude you met on Tinder is not going to be your white knight. Trust me.
Yes, yes, yes. It doesn't mean, hey, I'm a firm believer that we all for sure have, that soulmate, and that's the person in the mirror. And if you get connected with that one, you can definitely connect with someone on a very spiritual level, but it's not going to be as deep as what you can offer to yourself. So, I mean, just my perspective. And you said something incredibly valuable there. I want to add to, Joe, is communication. If you can't talk about what you're about to do or share, you shouldn't be doing it.
It is amazing. I mean, I just think about all the conversations that I've had around sex recently. And again, just this unbelievable honesty and transparency. And it's so meaningful. And just because I've chosen not to have it yet, those experiences are so precious because there is such an openness and an intimacy to it. Like, I went on a date with somebody recently and I said, look, I don't feel a sexual connection with you, but I haven't been touched in 4 months. How would you feel? Because this person had just done a lot of bodywork training in Bali. I was like, if you know, you came back to my hotel and gave me a massage. And it was like, all of a sudden, it's like, can I touch you here? No, that doesn't feel good, but I'd be open to this. And there were just such clear boundaries within it. It was so healing for me on a lot of levels to have a man really respect that and show up. And I was at the end, I'm like, will you just lay on me? It's like, skin, like weighted anxiety blanket. And it was awesome. And I'm like, holy, I could have been doing this my whole life instead of feeling obligated to have sex or craving what I wanted was connection at this heightened level. Because our brains are just blown out with dopamine and serotonin, like freaking everywhere. And I mean, I just can't get off this show without saying, like, men in porn, you just, please reevaluate your relationship with it. It kills intimacy. It has nothing to do with morality. Yep. You know, so often all the stuff out there as far as literature is religious based and shaming, and no one wants to hear that. So please reevaluate it, because it hurts everyone, but it is impacting men at such a dire level.
Yep.
And it's so normalized. It's like alcohol. And it's like, look, you should earn the novelty of seeing a woman naked, you know, or seeing a man naked. Like, and then when you're actually having to show up, earn it, do the work, there's so many processes that are happening in your brain and chemically that don't happen when you're just jacking off in front of a screen. Your dopamine cycles don't come to fruition and completion. It's like, it's so damaging. Ronnie Landis has a beautiful reset program out, but it's like, do your research. Not from a, you're bad. I mean, we all love sex. You know, not all, but like a lot of us do, especially those of us that have had issues with porn. We love it, right? But it's like, learn about what it's actually doing from a neurological, chemical, hormonal, intimacy, love, spiritual perspective. And you can't not change your relationship with it.
I couldn't have said it better. For the people that are just listening, I was going, yep, shaking my head, yep, the whole time. It's fact. Yeah. It's fact. It's just fact. Joe, we're going to have to do this again down the line. Deal?
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. All right. If you guys want to connect with Joe, go to joeweatherford.com. I'll have all the links in the podcast description, also for social media. It's time for those fun random questions. All right. Here we go. If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
It's to teleport. I love to travel. But I was just like, I'm in Ibiza or whatever. I know so many people would say something about longevity. And I do love my life, but I don't need to be here for 300 years. Like I'm soaking up every second of it. And if I could just be like, oh, the DJ I want to hear is in Ibiza, bam, I'm over there. Oh, I'm that would be rad. I would love that.
Right on. What would be something that people would be surprised to learn about you? Maybe a hobby or interest, something along those lines.
I used to own a martial arts school, so I'm a black belt, and yeah, my ex-husband and I did that, and I taught our little kids program. They started at 3, so I taught them from like age 3 until 9, and yeah, I love martial arts. It was a big part of my life.
What discipline or disciplines?
So my ex-husband was pretty genius in a lot of ways, aside from choosing to marry me. But he was doing MMA before it was trendy. So back in the early 90s, he created a school called Freestyle because it really was. It was Taekwondo, Muay Thai, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Krav Maga. It was really just this eclectic blend of disciplines. And so we trained in all those.
I love it. I dig it. Yeah, I did jiu-jitsu for a few years. So I'm probably the guy that it took the longest to get a stripe on his white belt. But oh, well.
Hey, oh, well.
I loved it. It was a great experience. This one's always fun. If you were on a deserted island and you could have one music artist's greatest hits and one movie, what would they be?
Stick Figure. 100%. I love Stick Figure. Reggae.
Oh, okay.
I was at a concert once and they were performing and it hit me. I was like, this is the epitome of flow state. Like these people are not performing music. They are channeling God. Check out Stick Figure. My favorite song in the entire world is Once in a Lifetime. One movie. Okay. A Star is Born is my favorite movie, but I wouldn't want to watch it on repeat. I got to go with something light and funny. So... so politically incorrect. I love Tropic Thunder.
Oh, God, it's great.
It's hilarious. So, yeah, I'd have Tropic Thunder.
It's so great. Now, you say A Star is Born. Is this the Kris Kristofferson or is this the Lady Gaga?
It's all Bradley Cooper. Yeah.
Okay.
Lady Gaga. They are such amazing humans. And then, of course, he's sober and producer, singer, actor. Some people just come in and just have so much to offer. There's no words, but that movie for me, beautifully paints addiction, the music, the sound, the acting, everything about it is next level.
Absolutely. All right. Last one here. Best and worst advice you've ever received that you can recall.
Okay. Ironically, it's the same piece of advice, but it's context. Okay. So I grew up with a mother that was just very in her masculine and very just like deal with it. You know, that was her personality. She was actually the first Hispanic commercial airline pilot ever. So you could just see like blowing through glass ceilings. But like when it came to emotional stuff, like this is very, very, she and I were laughing this morning. She's like, I lack empathy. And I'm like, yeah, no. You know, like, glad you see that. But I had just started a counseling practice at the university and she brings me a gift. Okay. And it's a plaque of something she said to me my whole life. Now, this is going on the wall, theoretically, of a counseling office. You got to remember that. And it says, put on your big girl panties and deal with it. And it is the best and worst advice ever because yes, that is what we need to do. And I'm not going to put that on the wall of my counseling office.
Oh, that's too good. Joe, the floor is yours. Anything that you would want to lend words of encouragement, anything?
There's two things that have stuck out to me throughout my career that resonate so deeply. And the first is healing is always possible. And you and I, when we were briefly discussing the opiate crisis before we got going on the show, you know, the only time that we can't be saved is when we're dead. So it is so important that we have things like Narcan and that we have treatment available. We need to really shift our focus onto that, away from the supply issue and looking at demand and treatment and mental health interventions that work. I'm actually going in May to do Ibogaine, which is a shamanic plant root. It's a very intense ceremony that really is supposed to help with opiate withdrawal and addiction. And for me, I want to go experience it so I can talk about it, because we've got to have other options available. What we're doing right now isn't working. And if you are somebody that is buying drugs off the street, you just can't anymore. Again, it's not a moral issue. It's like, you don't have that luxury. I bought shit off the street all the time and I was fine. It's not just fentanyl. There is a new synthetic opiate out now that they are saying is between 100 and 800 times stronger than fentanyl. And some of my dear friends just lost their son. He was the third reported case, but this is about to flood the United States. You cannot buy drugs off the dark web or from people. Like, unless you know the chemist, don't do that. Because here's the other thing, you can't test for it. This poor kid actually tested for fentanyl, but they manipulate the molecules and you can't test for these things. So please, please, please do not do that. So that's the first thing. Healing is always possible. We got to keep people alive long enough to actually try to help them help themselves. And then the other thing is, for people who love somebody with addiction, and it's, you cannot save people, you can only love them. That's a beautiful quote. And it's like, but also love yourself enough to set boundaries. I am not saying let that person destroy your life. I am saying you can love people just like you can forgive them, with exceptionally strong boundaries. And that love and that forgiveness first comes into you. And you've got to assess, what is my role? What are the dynamics where my savior complex, or my, I'm going to give everything of me to try to help this other person, your codependency is coming into play. So love yourself first. But I do love that quote. You cannot save people. You can only love them.
Absolutely. Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
Absolutely. And on that note, remember, no outside solutions to inside problems, and keep knocking doors down.